2013 to 2014. By the time he was a high school sophomore, Pete Saubers had already figured out the next step, a good college in New England, where literature instead of cleanliness was next to godliness. He began investigating online and collecting brochures. Emerson or BC seemed the most likely candidates, but Brown might not be out of reach. His mother and father told him not to get his hopes up, but Pete didn't buy that. He felt that if you didn't have hopes and ambitions when you were a teenager, you'd be pretty much fucked later on. About majoring in English, there was no question. Some of the surety had to do with John Rothstein and the Jimmy Gold novels. So far as Pete knew, he was the only person in the world who had read the final two, and they had changed his life. Howard Ricker, his sophomore English teacher, had also been life-changing, even though many kids made fun of him, calling him Ricky the Hippie because of the flower power shirts and bell-bottoms he favored. Pete's girlfriend, Gloria Moore, called him Pastor Ricky because he had a habit of waving his hands above his head when he got excited. Hardly anyone cut Mr. Ricker's classes, though. He was entertaining, he was enthusiastic, and unlike many of the teachers, he seemed to genuinely like the kids, whom he called my young ladies and gentlemen. They rolled their eyes at his retro clothes and his screechy laugh, but the clothes had a certain funky cachet, and the screechy laugh was so amiably weird it made you want to laugh along. On the first day of sophomore English, he blew in like a cool breeze, welcomed them, and then printed something on the board that Pete Saubers never forgot. This is stupid. What do you make of this, ladies and gentlemen? He asked. What on earth can it mean? The class was silent.
I'll tell you then. It happens to be the most common criticism made by young ladies and gentlemen such as yourselves, doomed to a course where we begin with excerpts from Beowulf and end with Raymond Carver. Among teachers, such survey courses are sometimes called GTTG, Gallop Through the Glories.
He screeched cheerfully, also waggling his hands at shoulder height in a yowza yowza gesture. Most of the kids laughed along, Pete among them.
Class verdict on Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal? This is stupid. Young Goodman Brown by Nathaniel Hawthorne? This is stupid. Mending Wall by Robert Frost? This is moderately stupid.
The required excerpt from Moby Dick? This is extremely stupid. More laughter. None of them had read Moby Dick, but they all knew it was hard and boring. Stupid, in other words. And sometimes, Mr. Ricker exclaimed, raising one finger and pointing dramatically at the words on the blackboard, sometimes, my young ladies and gentlemen, the criticism is spot on.
I stand here with my bare face hanging out and admit it. I am required to teach certain antiquities I would rather not teach.
I see the loss of enthusiasm in your eyes, and my soul groans. Yes,
groans. But I soldier on because I know that much of what I teach is not
stupid. Even some of the antiquities to which you feel you cannot relate now or ever will have deep resonance that will eventually reveal itself.
Shall I tell you how you judge the not stupid from the is stupid?
Shall I impart this great secret? Since we have 40 minutes left in this class and as yet no grist to grind in the mill of our combined intellects, I believe I will.
He leaned forward and propped his hands on the desk, his tie swinging like a pendulum. Pete felt that Mr. Ricker was looking directly at him, as if he knew, or at least intuited, the tremendous secret Pete was keeping under a pile of blankets in the attic of his house, something far more important than money. At some point in this course, perhaps even tonight, you will read something difficult, something you only partially understand, and your verdict will be, this is stupid. Will I argue when you advance that opinion in class the next day?
Why would I do such a useless thing?
My time with you is short, only 34 weeks of classes, and I will not waste it arguing about the merits of this short story or that poem. Why would I, when all such opinions are subjective and no final resolution can ever be reached? Some of the kids, Gloria was one of them, now looked lost, but Pete understood exactly what Mr. Ricker, a.k.a. Ricky the Hippie, was talking about, because since starting the notebooks, he had read dozens of critical essays on John Rothstein. Many of them judged Rothstein to be one of the greatest American writers of the 20th century, right up there with Fitzgerald, Hemingway, Faulkner, and Roth. There were others, a minority but a vocal one, who asserted that his work was second-rate and hollow. Pete had read a piece in Salon where the writer had called Rothstein king of the wisecrack and the patron saint of fools. "Time is the answer," Mr. Ricker said on the first day of Pete's sophomore year. He strode back and forth, antique bell-bottoms swishing, occasionally waving his arms. "Yes! Time mercilessly culls away the is-stupid from the not-stupid. It is a natural Darwinian process. It is why the novels of Graham Greene are available in every good bookstore and the novels of Somerset Maugham are not. Those novels still exist, of course, but you must order them. And you would only do that if you knew about them. Most modern readers do not. Raise your hand if you have ever heard of Somerset Maugham, and I'll spell that for you." No hands went up. Mr. Ricker nodded, rather grimly, it seemed to Pete. "Time has decreed that Mr. Green is not stupid, while Mr. Maugham is, well, not exactly stupid, but forgettable. He wrote some very fine novels, in my opinion. The Moon and Sixpence is remarkable, my young ladies and gentlemen. Remarkable. And he also wrote a great deal of excellent short fiction, but none is included in your textbook. Shall I weep over this? Shall I rage and shake my fists and proclaim injustice? No, I will not. Such culling is a natural process. It will occur for you, young ladies and gentlemen, although I will be in your rearview mirror by the time it happens. Shall I tell you how it happens? You will read something, perhaps Dulce et Decorum Est by Wilfred Owen. Shall we use that as an example? Why not? Then, in a deeper voice that sent chills up Pete's back and tightened his throat, Mr. Ricker cried, "Bent double. Like old beggars under sacks, knock-kneed, coughing like hags, we cursed through sludge." And so on, cetera, cetera. Some of you will say, "This is stupid." Well, I break my promise not to argue the point, even though I consider Mr. Owen's poems the greatest to come out of World War I. No, it's just my opinion, you see, and opinions are like assholes, everybody has one. They all roared at that, young ladies and gentlemen alike. Mr. Ricker drew himself up. "I may give some of you detentions if you disrupt my class. I have no problem with imposing discipline, but never will I disrespect your opinion." And yet, up went the finger. "Time will pass. Tempest will fugit. Owen's poem may fall away from your mind, in which case your verdict of is stupid will have turned out to be correct, for you, at least. But for some of you, it will recur, and recur, and recur. Each time it does, the steady march of your maturity will deepen its resonance. Each time that poem steals back into your mind, it will seem a little less stupid and a little more vital. A little more important, until it shines, young ladies and gentlemen, until it shines." Thus endeth my opening day peroration, and I ask you to turn to page 16 in that most excellent tome, Language and Literature. One of the stories Mr. Ricker assigned that year was The Rocking Horse Winner by D.H. Lawrence. And sure enough, many of Mr. Ricker's young ladies and gentlemen, including Gloria Moore, of whom Pete was growing tired in spite of her really excellent breasts, considered it stupid. Pete did not, in large part because events in his life had already caused him to mature beyond his years. As 2013 gave way to 2014, the year of the famed polar vortex, when furnaces all over the upper Midwest went into maximum overdrive, burning money by the bale, that story recurred to him often, and its resonance continued to deepen and recur. The family in it seemed to have everything, but they didn't. There was never quite enough, and the hero of the story, a young boy named Paul, always heard the house whispering, "There must be more money. There must be more money." Pete Saubers guessed that there were kids who considered that stupid. They were the lucky ones who had never been forced to listen to nightly arky-barkies about which bills to pay or the price of cigarettes. The young protagonist in the Lawrence story discovered a supernatural way to make money. By riding his toy rocking horse to the make-believe land of luck, Paul could pick horse race winners in the real world. He made thousands of dollars, and still the house whispered, "There must be more money." After one final epic ride on the rocking horse and one final big money pick, Paul dropped dead of a brain hemorrhage or something. Pete didn't have so much as a headache after finding the buried trunk, but it was still his rocking horse, wasn't it? Yes, his very own rocking horse. But by 2013, the year he met Mr. Ricker, the rocking horse was slowing down. The trunk money had almost run out. It had gotten his parents through a rough and scary patch when their marriage might otherwise have crashed and burned. This Pete knew, and he never once regretted playing guardian angel. In the words of that old song, the trunk money had formed a bridge over troubled waters, and things were better, much, on the other side. The worst of the recession was over. Mom was teaching full time again, her salary $3,000 a year better than before. Dad now ran his own small business. Not real estate exactly, but something called Real Estate Search. He had several agencies in the city as clients. Pete didn't completely understand how it worked, but he knew it was actually making some money and might make more in the years ahead if the housing market continued to trend upward. He was agenting a few properties of his own, too. Best of all, he was drug-free and walking well. The crutches had been in the closet for over a year, and he only used his cane on rainy or snowy days when his bones and joints ached. All good. Great, in fact. And yet, as Mr. Ricker said at least once in every class, and yet. There was Tina to think about. That was one very large and yet. Many of her friends from the old neighborhood on the west side, including Barbara Robinson, whom Tina had idolized, were going to Chapel Ridge, a private school that had an excellent record when it came to sending kids on to good colleges. Mom had told Tina that she and Dad didn't see how they could afford to send her there directly from middle school. Maybe she could attend as a sophomore if their finances continued to improve. "But I won't know anybody by then," Tina had said, starting to cry. "You'll know Barbara Robinson," Mom said, and Pete, listening from the next room, could tell from the sound of her voice that Mom was on the verge of tears herself. Hilda and Betsy, too. But teens had been a little younger than those girls, and Pete knew only Barb's had been a real friend to his sister back in the West Side days. Hilda Carver and Betsy DeWitt probably didn't even remember her. Neither would Barbara in another year or two. Their mother didn't seem to remember what a big deal high school was and how quickly you forgot your little kid friends once you got there. Tina's response summed up these thoughts with admirable succinctness. "Yeah, but they won't know me." "Tina, you have that money," Tina cried. "That mystery money that comes every month. Why can't I have some for Chapel Ridge?"
"Because we're still catching up from the bad time, honey."
To this, Tina could say nothing, because it was true. His own college plans were another, and yet. Pete knew that to some of his friends, maybe most of them, college seemed as far away as the outer planets of the solar system. But if he wanted a good one, Brown, his mind whispered, English lit at Brown. That meant making early applications when he was a first semester senior. The applications themselves cost money, as did the summer class he needed to pick up if he wanted to score at least a 670 on the math part of the SATs. He had a part-time job at the Garner Street Library, but $35 a week didn't go far. Dad's business had grown enough to make a downtown office desirable. That was, and yet, number 3. Just a low-rent place on an upper floor and being close to the action would pay dividends, but it would mean laying out more money, and Pete knew, even though no one said it out loud, that Dad was counting on the mystery cash to carry him through the critical period. They had all come to depend on the mystery cash, and only Pete knew it would be gone before the end of 14. And yeah, okay, he had spent some on himself. Not a huge amount, that would have raised questions, but 100 here and 100 there, a blazer and a pair of loafers for the class trip to Washington, a few CDs and books. He had become a fool for books since reading The Notebooks and falling in love with John Rothstein. He began with Rothstein's Jewish contemporaries like Philip Roth, Saul Bellow, and Irwin Shaw. He thought The Young Lions was fucking awesome and couldn't understand why it wasn't a classic, and spread out from there. He always bought paperbacks, but even those were $12 or $15 a piece these days unless you could find them used. The Rocking Horse Winner had resonance, all right. Big time resonance, because Pete could hear his own house whispering, "There must be more money." And all too soon, there would be less. But money wasn't all the trunk had contained, was it? That was another "and yet," one Pete Saubers thought about more and more as time passed. For his end-of-year research paper in Mr. Ricker's Gallop Through the Glories, Pete did a 16-page analysis of the Jimmy Gold trilogy, quoting from various reviews and adding in stuff from the few interviews Rothstein had given before retreating to his farm in New Hampshire and going completely dark. He finished by talking about Rothstein's tour of the German death camps as a reporter for the New York Herald, this 4 years before publishing the first Jimmy Gold book. "I believe that was the most important event of Mr. Rothstein's life," Pete wrote, "surely the most important event of his life as a writer. Jimmy's search for meaning always goes back to what Mr. Rothstein saw in those camps, and it's why, when Jimmy tries to live the life of an ordinary American citizen, he always feels hollow. For me, this is best expressed when he throws an ashtray through the TV in The Runner Slows Down. He does it during a CBS News special about the Holocaust." When Mr. Ricker returned their papers, a big A+ was scrawled on Pete's cover, which was a computer-scanned photo of Rothstein as a young man sitting in Sardi's with Ernest Hemingway. Below the A+, Mr. Ricker had written, "See me after class." When the other kids were gone, Mr. Ricker looked at Pete so fixedly that Pete was momentarily scared his favorite teacher was going to accuse him of plagiarism. Then Mr. Ricker smiled. "That is the best student paper I've read in my 28 years of teaching, because it was the most confident and the most deeply felt." Pete's face heated with pleasure. "Thanks. Really? Thanks a lot." "I'd argue with your conclusion, though," Mr. Ricker said, leaning back in his chair and lacing his fingers together behind his neck. "The characterization of Jimmy as a noble American hero like Huck Finn is not supported by the concluding book of the trilogy. Yes, he throws an ashtray at the television screen, but it's not an act of heroism. The CBS logo is an eye, you know, and Jimmy's act is a ritual blinding of his inner eye, the one that sees the truth. That's not my insight. It's an almost direct quote from an essay called The Runner Turns Away by John Crow Ransom. Leslie Fiedler says much the same in Love and Death in the American Novel. But I'm not trying to debunk you, Pete. I'm just saying you need to follow the evidence of any book wherever it leads. And that means not omitting crucial developments that run counter to your thesis. What does Jimmy do after he throws the ashtray through the TV, and after his wife delivers her classic line, 'You bastard, how will the kids watch Mickey Mouse now?'" "He goes out and buys another TV set, but not just any TV set, but the first color TV set on the block. And then he creates the big successful ad campaign for Does He Do Household Cleaner, but Mr. Ricker raised his eyebrows, waiting for the but. And how could Pete tell him that a year later, Jimmy steals into the agency late one night with matches and a can of kerosene? That Rothstein foreshadows all the protests about Vietnam and civil rights by having Jimmy start a fire that pretty much destroys the building known as the Temple of Advertising? That he hitchhikes out of New York City without a look back, leaving his family behind and striking out for the territory just like Huck and Jim? He couldn't say any of that because it was the story told in The Runner Goes West, a novel that existed only in 17 closely written notebooks that had lain buried in an old trunk for over 30 years. "Go ahead and butt me your butts," Mr. Ricker said equably. "There's nothing I like better than a good book discussion with someone who can hold up his end of the argument. I imagine you've already missed your bus, but I'll be more than happy to give you a ride home." He tapped the cover sheet of Pete's paper. Johnny R. and Ernie H., those twin titans of American literature with oversized martini glasses raised in a toast. "Unsupported conclusion aside, which I put down to a touching desire to see light at the end of an extremely dark final novel, this is extraordinary work. Just extraordinary. So go for it. Butt me your butts." "But nothing, I guess," Pete said. "You could be right." Only Mr. Ricker wasn't. Any doubt about Jimmy Gold's capacity to sell out that remained at the end of The Runner Goes West was swept away in the last and longest novel of the series, The Runner Raises the Flag. It was the best book Pete had ever read, also the saddest.
"In your paper, you didn't go into how Rothstein died."
"No."
"May I ask why not?"
"Because it didn't fit the theme, I guess, and it would have made the paper too long. Also, well, it was such a bummer for him to die that way, getting killed in a stupid burglary."
"He shouldn't have kept cash in the house," Mr. Ricker said mildly. "But he did, and a lot of people knew it. Don't judge him too harshly for that. Many writers have been stupid and improvident about money. Charles Dickens found himself supporting a family of slackers, including his own father. Samuel Clemens was all but bankrupted by bad real estate transactions. Arthur Conan Doyle lost thousands of dollars to fake mediums and spent thousands more on fake photos of fairies. At least Rothstein's major work was done. Unless you believe, as some people do." Pete looked at his watch.
Mr. Ricker, I can still catch my bus if I hurry."
Mr. Ricker did that funny yowza yowza thing with his hands. "Go, by all means, go. I just wanted to thank you for such a wonderful piece of work. And to offer a friendly caution, when you approach this kind of thing next year and in college, don't let your good nature cloud your critical eye. The critical eye should always be cold and clear."
"I won't," Pete said, and hurried out. The last thing he wanted to discuss with Mr. Ricker was the possibility that the thieves who had taken John Rothstein's life had stolen a bunch of unpublished manuscripts as well as money, and maybe destroyed them after deciding they had no value. Once or twice, Pete had played with the idea of turning the notebooks over to the police, even though that would almost surely mean his parents would find out where the mystery money had been coming from. The notebooks were, after all, evidence of a crime as well as a literary treasure. But it was an old crime, ancient history. Better to leave well enough alone. "Right?"